Hello and welcome to the first of the CR Focus News podcasts. We're going to be publishing one of these every month where myself, Andrew Smith, and a guest presenter dig into the month's news and find out some interesting behind-the-scenes aspects to it. This month, for our inaugural podcast, I'm very pleased to be joined by Adam Jacobs.
Hello, Andrew.
Adam is director of Dianthus Medical. He is a medical writer and aesthetician, former president of EMWA, the European Medical Writers Association, and also an ethics committee member for the past 8 years or so, isn't it?
About that, yeah.
So plenty of diverse perspectives to bring to all of the month's news. Just to give you an idea of what we're going to be doing, all of these news items are featured on the ICR website during the past 6 weeks. All of them, bar one of the items we're going to talk about this afternoon, are also in the February issue of CR Focus magazine. One story broke just after we went to print, so that one won't be included. So we're going to be talking in a bit more detail about several of the month's news items. And the items we've chosen for this month are the European Medicines Agency opening a public discussion on the need for active controls in clinical trials, the Academy of Medical Sciences proposal to make major changes to the governance of clinical research in the UK, an FDA announcement for a new required element on informed consent forms, the report from the second phase of the Northwest Exemplar project, which aimed to improve the UK's clinical research competitiveness, the scandal and ructions at the French regulator AFSAPS over the diabetes drug Mediator, and also the announcement that Pfizer will be closing its sandwich plant by the end of 2012. So to lead us off on the first one of those, Adam, talk to us about active control.
Okay, well, the European Medicines Agency, according to this news story I have in front of me, has published a reflection paper on the need for active control in therapeutic areas where use of a placebo is deemed ethical and one or more established medicines are available. This paper is open for public consultation, so if anybody's got any views on this, do get in touch with the EMA and let them know what you think. It's always a tricky one, placebo in clinical trials, where there are established treatments, because is that ever ethical? Yes, it probably is, provided that the disease isn't too serious and that no great harm is going to come from delaying treatment. And that's recognised in the Declaration of Helsinki. But for a lot of diseases, it's going to be a tough sell to recruit patients to trials where you're going to recruit them potentially to placebo when there is something effective they could be taken. So, you know, maybe if we can have more trials with active controls and fewer placebo-controlled trials, that's going to be a good thing for the ethics of trials. But I think there's another really important point here, which is that with a lot of drugs, we don't really care if they work better than placebo. If there are already established drugs on the market, you know, we want to know, does this drug work as well as what's already on the market? And I don't know if you remember a few weeks ago, Andrew, there was a bit of a hoo-ha about Reboxetine. There's some articles in the British Medical Journal. Reboxetine was approved in Europe, but not by the FDA, or maybe it was the other way around. But the data were interesting because Reboxetine had done better than placebo in clinical trials. But if you compare it to a lot of other antidepressants, like the SSRIs, it actually performed considerably less well. And there was an interesting analysis by some of the people at ICFIC in Germany, looking at all the data, much of which hadn't been published. And that showed quite clearly when you looked at it, the Reboxetine was, you know, maybe a little bit better than placebo, but certainly not as good as established antidepressants. And you can argue whether Reboxetine should ever have been approved in the first place under those circumstances. But I think, you know, if we have more clinical trials with active controls where there's effective treatment already out there, then, you know, maybe we can avoid another situation like the rather unfortunate mess that we got into with Reboxetine.
Absolutely. Now, do you think that there's also any significance in the fact that this is coming from the European Medicines Agency as opposed to the World Medical Association? What makes it through the EMEA process is how we must work, whereas the Declaration of Helsinki is a guideline.
Well, some would argue the Declaration of Helsinki is also how we must work. I don't think it has any legal force, but I think most medical associations would expect doctors to conform to it. Yes, it's interesting. I mean, maybe the European Medicines Agency are thinking along those lines of, you know, we don't really want to be approving drugs if they're maybe slightly better than placebo, but not as effective as other drugs. Mm. I mean, I can think of circumstances where you might want to do that anyway. Perhaps, you know, if not all patients respond to the other drugs, perhaps it's good to have a backup plan. But certainly you'd hope that if a drug was approved on that basis, that would be very clearly stated in the labelling that, you know, this drug is indicated for patients with such and such a disease who have failed to respond to established treatment. So maybe they're thinking of that would just be a better way to get appropriate labelling for drugs.
And given the attitude of the FDA and other regulators towards aspects of the Declaration of Helsinki, this is a way to maybe entrench one of those principles into the legal structure in a way that it's maybe harder to do.
Yeah, I think so. I'm going to say there's kind of dual use to this. There's hopefully getting better information to know whether medicines are better than existing ones. But also, you know, maybe if we've got more active controlled trials, we can, you know, we can have more ethical trials with fewer patients treated by placebo where it's not strictly necessary.
Absolutely.
Shall we move on?
Shall we move on, indeed. The next item I wanted to mention was the Academy of Medical Sciences report, which was published on January the 11th this year, about a month ago. I'm going to keep this piece fairly brief because we've gone into it in quite an amount of detail in February's issue of CR Focus.
And there's a great article for you all to read if you haven't already.
Absolutely. So go away and again, once again, read the report. I suppose there's a raft of recommendations. There are 17 recommendations. A lot of the press coverage has gone towards the creation of the Healthcare Research Agency, but there were many other recommendations included in the report as well, such as changes to the Human Tissue Act, changes to the role of contact guardians with regard to patient data, and moves to change the culture around research, particularly in the NHS. I suppose one of the interesting questions now is how much of this is going to be taken up and how quickly might things start taking effect.
And who's going to take it up as well? Because some of these things are specific recommendations that government can do something about, like reforming the Human Tissue Act, which personally I think is well overdue. I think that's a dreadful piece of knee-jerk legislation. But the more subtle things about changing the culture, you know, who's going to take responsibility for that? And that remains to be seen, I think.
Absolutely. In the interview, separate interview with Professor Sir Michael Rawlins, who chaired the review, he felt that some of the recommendations could be in place within 6 months. Well, obviously, things that require primary legislation, such as the Human Tissue Act, would take a little longer. But many of these recommendations could just be done, or done with secondary legislation. So if the government is willing, many of these things could be done fairly quickly. But bearing in mind this report was commissioned by the previous Labour government, and there's a lot of change going on within the NHS as well.
And governments don't usually listen even to the reports they've commissioned themselves, let alone the reports the other guys have commissioned. So
I think that there's plenty of good things in the report. How many of them get taken up remains to be seen.
I didn't think there was anything earth-shattering in the report, but there's lots of little things, and they probably add up to quite a useful improvement in the system if they were all implemented. But we'll have to wait and see whether anybody listens to it.
So watch this space. Next item, this is one for you again, Adam.
Yes, okay, so this is the FDA have announced a new required element for informed consent forms. It's a pretty minor change, but I think it's quite interesting. The FDA want informed consent forms for clinical trials to include a specific statement that clinical trial information will be entered into a data bank that is publicly accessible at clinicaltrials.gov. I kind of have mixed feelings about this. On the one hand, I think we have a huge problem with informed consent forms, that they're hideously bureaucratic as they are. And if you follow all these recommendations for everything that people like the FDA and GCP and things tell you to do with informed consent forms, you can end up with a ridiculous 20-page document that no patient is ever going to read. So I think we need to be careful with anything that increases requirements for informed consent forms. On the other hand, I think getting patients to engage with the results of the trials they're in is a really good thing. You know, I would like patients to know that the results are accessible on clinicaltrials.gov. I think, you know, that can only be a good thing if patients know what's going on and the public in general are more aware of what's going on in clinical trials.
Now, this is an item that, obviously, while it's based in the US, has implications for everyone working in Europe, and most people who listen to this podcast are going to be based in Europe. Obviously, also, the clinicaltrials.gov website has its parallel with the UDRAC database. Certainly, if they're not live yet, there have been plans in place to extend that to include publicly accessible information and eventually publicly accessible information on trial results. So it'll be interesting to see how quickly this sort of recommendation flows through into EMA guidance as well.
Yeah. The opening up the UDRAC database to make the results publicly accessible can't come soon enough, in my opinion. I can't understand why they didn't do that from day one. But anyway, they're working on that now, which
Absolutely.
Is to be welcomed.
I think the plan had been that it was going to be in a technical update that was released in the latter part of 2010, but I also believe that it ran into technical problems and has been delayed, so I don't think it's live just yet.
Gosh, technical problems with big government-run computer systems. Who'd have thought it, eh?
Absolutely. These things never happen. Okay, the next one is another item that I flagged up. This is the Northwest Exemplar Project, which has now published the second of its three reports, again in the middle of January. For those of you who don't know about the project, basically this involved three trusts in the northwest of England using the best of their vigour and the best of the tools at their disposal to really try to push through delivery of 20 random trials, basically 20 trials that the next 20 trials that turned up in their in-tray went through this process, with a lot of buy-in and vigour on the part of the R&D team, all the way through into the higher reaches of the trust that were involved as well. The second phase of the report published some quite useful information about the startup times in comparison to other parts of Europe. Also, the fact that I think 7 of the 20 studies that were included recruited the first patient worldwide in one of these three sites. And also that there was a much better effect of sticking to the recruitment track. I think 18 of the 20 studies are either already meeting their recruitment targets or on track to meet their recruitment targets in total. The next phase is going to be about how everything is rolled out to the rest of the UK, how many of the lessons that were learned that were picked up as good practice in individual parts of the exemplar can then be rolled out to the rest of the UK, and how we can start to turn around the metrics much more broadly.
Hmm. This is something I didn't know much about until you told me about it earlier today, Andrew, but it's interesting stuff, because I think it shows just the power of, you know, doing what we know we should be doing, because I don't think there's anything particularly new in here, is it? It's not rocket science. There's just a lot of best practice recommendations that we already knew about. But when you actually start to do them, rather than just write them in a best practice recommendation somewhere that you then file away and forget about, it makes a big difference.
That's absolutely the point. Tools like the modern contracting agreements, the costing templates, things that have actually been around for a number of years, when they're used by people who know how to use them well, in a team that is really pushing to make things happen, you can show good results.
Yeah, and I think that's so applicable to healthcare more generally. I don't know if you saw it, there was a tweet from Richard Smith on Twitter recently, former editor of the British Medical Journal, who pointed out that if we actually just did all the things we know are effective, that would have a much, much bigger impact on healthcare than any new research we might ever do in the future. And I think he's probably right about that.
Absolutely.
So it's good to know that just by doing stuff that you know you should be doing, it has the outcomes you want. So you kind of wonder why people don't do it.
That's it. I think we should all go away and do the things we know we should be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to do that this afternoon.
That's it.
Yeah.
Marvellous. Moving on, this is another one.
Okay, so shock, horror, major scandal. This is a terrible scandal involving the French and the pharmaceutical industry and corrupt politicians and everything, and is terribly scandalous, possibly. Or should that be allegedly?
I think allegedly is the
yes.
word.
Yes, nothing in this podcast should be taken as defamatory or anything like that. So, yes, this is a drug called Mediator, an anti-diabetes drug that's been prescribed in France very widely, not just for diabetes, but also as a weight loss drug, for which it was never licensed. It was only ever licensed as a diabetes drug. And that's just been withdrawn from the market quite recently. But apparently people knew over a decade ago that this drug had some quite serious side effects, caused heart valve problems. And some people have died, and the actual numbers of people who have died, well, we've got a couple of news stories here. I'm looking at something from the BBC website that says between 500 and 2,000 people in France are believed to have died because of its side effects. Obviously, the medical statistician in me is saying, how do you know? Because those sorts of things are extraordinarily difficult to measure. But, I mean, clearly there was a problem, and clearly, you know, even if it's only 100 people that died from it, from a weight loss drug, that is actually pretty scandalous.
Absolutely.
So something obviously went wrong there. And, you know, I often kind of look at these sort of shock, horror, evil pharmaceutical industry scandal stories with a bit of a jaded eye, because so many of them are sexed up a bit, because evil pharmaceutical companies eating babies and things always makes great copy for newspapers. But this one does actually look like it's potentially quite serious, because the head of AFSAPS, the French regulatory agency, has actually resigned over it, which presumably he wouldn't have done if there were nothing in this.
And I think resigned quite suddenly, within a day or two of the publication of the report into the scandal.
So, you know, if it was indeed known that this drug had potentially fatal side effects 10 years ago, then there's obviously some serious questions to be asked about why it took so long for the drug to be withdrawn from the market.
Absolutely.
And there's some suggestions in some of these news stories that there may be some skullduggery going on. Yeah, I mean, just looking at the BBC website again, it says here, the affair has become politicised as the pharmaceutical company which manufactured the drug, Servier, reportedly had high-level political connections. And there's another story which mentions that...
I think maybe some links between the French president, Nicolas Sarkozy...
Yes, that's right, here we are. Industry watchers say that over the years... Jacques Servier has funded numerous medical foundations and research fellowships. He has also cultivated politicians of all stripes, not least of them Nicolas Sarkozy. So there's obviously a suggestion here that there's some skullduggery going on, which of course is impossible to prove, and obviously we're not making any allegations here. This is all from the BBC website, so if anyone from Servier is listening and doesn't like this, sue the BBC,
That's not us. I think also a pinch of salt is required because of the duration of this. I mean, the first withdrawals, I think, took place in about 1997. It was withdrawn in the US, I think 1999 it was withdrawn in Spain. Obviously, that was some time before Nicolas Sarkozy had any high office. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I personally always go for the cock-up over the conspiracy every time. I suspect that, you know, whatever went wrong here was somebody just simply not doing their job properly rather than any underhand influence.
That's it.
I'm sure the truth will come out. I believe there's a court case starting on Friday, so
indeed
we will learn more about it. Definitely one to watch for the future.
Absolutely.
I think also
what happens going on from this will be quite significant. French Health Minister Xavier Bertrand said that the agency has failed in its mission.
Yeah, that's a pretty strong statement as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. And as a result of this, he is looking to tighten the approval processes, accelerate reviews of other drugs on its watch list, and run lots of reforms through the organisation, not least of which is changing its funding profile. AFSAPS will now be 100% funded by government, whereas in the past it's been 80% funded by industry fees. I'm wondering whether that sets any kind of a precedent for regulated elsewhere.
Well, that's an interesting question, Andrew, because people often say that there is a conflict of interest where you have regulators funded by the industry. I struggle to see how that works, actually, because although they are funded by the industry, they get funded the same way whether they approve the drugs or turn them down. So maybe that conflict of interest is a bit overstated. I personally don't feel too horrified by the idea that regulatory agencies are charging pharmaceutical industry user fees. Obviously, if they were related to the decisions, that would be a different matter.
Yes.
But I think there's some pretty, pretty good controls in there to make sure they're not.
Now, there's one final story that we couldn't leave this podcast without discussing, and that was the announcement by Pfizer a little over a week ago that they'll be making a number of cuts worldwide, not least of which will involve the closure of the Sandwich site in Kent and the loss of around 2,500 jobs by the end of 2012. This has been all over the media in the past few days, and everyone is very emotional about the entire thing.
Yeah, it's a sad day. You know, obviously the Pfizer Sandwich site has been extraordinarily productive in the past, and to close it down is a, you know, a sad day in the history of the way clinical research is going.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people are concerned that this is a bellwether for UK pharma in general. I know that there were some behind the scenes discussions between government and Pfizer before this happened, which evidently weren't successful. But perhaps it might send a signal that more discussion is needed. I'm a little concerned also that there might be more of a significance in terms of the place of the UK within global clinical development and who the audience is for which new medicines are being developed.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly much of the world's economy is moving east, and you know, we're seeing a lot of people doing drug development work in India these days, much more than we used to. And certainly India and Asia in general is, you know, that is the future of the world economy. You know, us poor sods in the West are a history, or at least we soon will be. So whether this is, you know, all linking into that, I don't know, but it has to be something you think about.
From the UK's perspective, trying to adapt to the world as it is, as part of a globalised market, as opposed to the way things were maybe 20 years ago when we were pretty much the only game in town as far as clinical development was concerned. I think it sends another signal that we need to get better at doing what we're good at, maybe stop trying to do everything and focus on the places where we can really make a difference for our own patients. I think that there's a lot to be said for research that can much more directly relate performance of a medicine to the sorts of treatment patterns, the sorts of patients that we see in the UK, rather than trying to do entire phase three programs in one country or in one part of the world.
Yeah, I mean, this country's always been particularly good at innovating, and we can't lose that. That would be crazy if we did. So it's, you know, it's a shame that Pfizer is closing the sandwich site when they have been so innovative. But hopefully they have a cunning plan to keep the innovation. We can only hope.
Absolutely. And certainly our thoughts go out to everyone who's affected by this, not just at Pfizer, but in the support companies around that as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Before we close, there were a couple of other items that we're not going to have time to discuss in full, but we wanted to at least highlight to you, maybe go to the ICR website and read the full story. So a couple of other things to be aware of. The FDA has issued draft guidance on electronic source documentation.
Oh, goody. That's always going to be fun to read, isn't it?
The EMA, on the other hand, has countered with guidance on medicines based on stem cells. And to present the entire thing back to market, the ABPI, the ABHI, the BIA and BIVDA, the British In Vitro Diagnostic Association, have formed Life Sciences UK, a new unified lobby group to represent all aspects of the life science industry back to government.
Let's hope they listen.
That's it. And one final thing, the ongoing saga of Sanofi Aventis and their bid to acquire Genzyme hasn't quite got to a conclusion yet. It's been rattling on for a number of months, but things appear to be getting rather closer, to the extent that Genzyme's board has authorised Sanofi Aventis to enter a confidentiality agreement for the due diligence process to begin. I think there is still some speculation about whether the share price of $69 will be the final bid price, but it looks to be coming to a conclusion. Another thing that's coming to a conclusion is this podcast. I'd like to thank Adam Jacobs once again for talking through the news with me.
It's been a pleasure, Andrew.
And as this was the first issue of this podcast, I'd particularly welcome any feedback you care to give on what we might do better, what we've done well, what you've enjoyed, which items you'd like to see discussed next time.
And don't forget to tell all your friends about this podcast in case they haven't heard it yet.
And listen again, same time, same place, in about a month's time. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.